So, I have known our speaker, John Amadeo, for, I'm thinking it's close to 30 years now at this point. Something 25, mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. that. Quite a while. He is the author of some of the books that you see here arrayed before you, including Love and Betrayal, Being Intimate, A Guide to Successful Relationships, The Authentic Heart. And he has spoken here before, and he has very generously agreed to leap into a suddenly vacant position tonight. And I see that many people have taken advantage of that fact to come and hear him, and I'm delighted that both events have occurred. So thank you so much for coming tonight, and I'm looking forward
My
to
pleasure.
The talk.
Thanks so much. Well, it's really great to be here, and such a great resource to have many rivers in the community, isn't it? Wonderful that these guys are here doing this work. Yeah. So I thought I'd start off with a few quotes from the real experts on love. And the first one is Mike. His name is Mike. He's 10 years old, and he was asked, "What do most people do on a first date?" He says, "On a first date, they just tell lies." And that usually gets them interested enough to go for a second date. Okay. And then Roger was asked, "What is it like to fall in love?" He's 9 years old. He said, "It's like an avalanche where you have to run for your life." Okay, so you can relate to that. And then Regina, age 10, she says, "I'm not rushing into being in love. I'm finding fourth grade hard enough." So I've been working as a marriage and family therapist for over 30 years now, and I've had a spiritual practice since I was about 20 years old. So I never quite felt at home in the psychology world. They just didn't have enough of the spiritual aspect for me. There wasn't enough depth, and there wasn't an interest in meditation among people that were into personal growth. And then the people in the personal growth, and then on the other hand, people into the spiritual realm, they weren't that much into intimacy and relationship. They thought, you know, don't get too attached to your relationship. Don't, you know, be careful when you're in love with somebody, run the other way. Just cultivate your own solitude and your own solitary practice. So I never felt quite at home in either world. So I've always been interested in, well, how can we integrate these two worlds? So that's what I want to talk about a little bit tonight. And I'm actually working on a book on this right now, and I think I maybe just found a publisher for it. It's about intimacy, sort of spirituality as a path toward intimacy. So I'll be looking forward to that coming out, because I've been working on that one for about 10 years now. So what I think is clear is that our deepest longing is to connect, is for love. And if you think of, just notice where your thoughts tend to go. Often they go to our longing for connection, for love, for intimacy. And yet it's also the source of the most pain and misery in our lives, isn't it? Rejection, abandonment, betrayal, we've probably all tasted that. And some people maybe want to give up on love at that point. But, you know, it's all a learning process. The poet Pablo Neruda, some of you know him. I was just in Chile last month and gave a talk down there. He says, "Love is so short, forgetting so long." Isn't that a good one? But he's also aware that the pain that we go through can help transform us and make us more available for connection. So he also says, "Give me your hands out of the depths sown by your sorrows. Give me your hand out of the depths sown by your sorrows." There's something about embracing the sorrows and the pain that kind of deepens us in a certain way. And Gibran talks a lot about that too. So I thought I should mention a little bit, the title of the talk is The Yoga of Intimacy. So why did I call it that? Did some of you like, did you like that title?
Yeah.
Really?
Sounds like a book title.
Really? Keep that in mind. So why did I call it that? Well, it's a spiritual bookstore, so we need to have titles that have a kind of a spiritual bent. But also, if you really think about relationships, I mean, when you think, if you look at what the word yoga means, it means union, right? It means connection. So what better arena to cultivate connections and find what it takes to connect with somebody than, you know, than relationships? So I'm going to talk a little bit more later how we can see it as kind of a spiritual practice or kind of a yoga practice to be in ourselves in a certain way where we create a climate where intimacy and connection happens. So I see it very much as a spiritual practice to have a healthy relationship. Okay. So have you noticed all the isolation that's around in our society? People are so disconnected, right? Like, we all have this longing to connect, and yet there's so much isolation. Like, it's kind of an epidemic of depression in our world. People are so disconnected. Why is this the case? I think a lot of it is, you know, we're so disconnected from ourselves in a certain way. And if we learn how to get more connected to ourselves in ways that I'm going to talk about soon, then we have our best chance at really connecting with other people. So I want to talk a little bit about desire. Is that a topic that interests anyone? Longing, desire? You're familiar with the first noble truth of Buddhism, right? That life is saturated with suffering. And then the second noble truth is, what's the cause of the suffering? So what's the second noble truth? We'll test your Buddhism knowledge here.
Suffering causes desire.
Desire causes suffering. Yeah?
Actually, not creating.
Well, okay, so we got smart aleck here.
Well, it's an important distinction.
No, I'm going to go into that. Like, you're getting a little bit ahead of me here. Taking my best lines. No, that is the common interpretation, that desire, you know, creates suffering. So then the logical next step is to eliminate desire, right? Isn't that how people tend to interpret the third noble truth? We need to eliminate this desire or this craving in order to be happy, to find freedom and liberation. Well, if you really look at it, the word is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, and it's considered by a lot of scholars now to be a mistranslation to call it desire. It really means thirst, or like Patrick says, craving that causes the suffering. Because desire just arises in our experience. We can't help but have desire. It's part of being alive. But it's how we work with it that really makes the key difference in whether we move toward happiness and connection with each other, or whether we move toward suffering. So I want to switch gears a little and talk a little bit about attachment theory. Are some of you familiar with attachment theory? There's actually a great book that Rob just happened to put up called A General Theory of Love. It's really a great book on attachment theory. Mm-hmm. And some of you familiar with this at all?
Is that with child development?
Yeah, it starts with child development. John Bowlby developed this stuff in the 50s. And he was competing with the behaviorists at the time, so he wasn't very popular because he thought you should actually hug and kiss your children. It was like an outrageous idea to the behaviorists. They thought you would set your, if you keep coddling children too much, you would set them up for, well, John Watson, the main behaviorist, said if you send your kids to pajama parties or the Boy Scouts or the YMCA, they might become homosexual. Imagine that. So he tried to protect people from that. And so John Watson was very denigrated at the time for suggesting that we hold our children, that we look in their eyes. And actually, we know now that the brain of infants develop when we look in their eyes. There's something really magical, isn't there, about eye contact? Something really mysterious about that. Yeah. Right. And, you know, secure attachment in a child happens when the parents are sensitively attuned to the child, when they're really there, they listen, they respond, they make contact. They're emotionally available. The parents are accepting of the child. And what we know now is that not only children need this, but we need this as adults too. That we need this for healthy immune functioning. There's like tons of studies now about how healthy attachment, healthy connection helps our health. Our immune system becomes more robust if we have good friends, maybe a partner, connection with the community. And without that, we tend to suffer. So one way it's expressed is this lack of felt security. Like in infants, they don't develop a secure internal base. If we don't have a secure internal base, we set ourselves up for difficulty later in our adult life and our relationships, because we don't have a secure self to fall back on. And of course, this is where things like meditation, focusing, therapy can really help us heal some of those old wounds. But, you know, we're setting ourselves up for more difficulty if we don't have that secure internal base. So, So the attachment theory people are saying we suffer, well, the Buddhists are saying we suffer because of our desires and the way some people interpret our attachments. You've heard this? You've heard people say that? And then the attachment people are saying we suffer because we don't have healthy attachment. So which is true? Well, that's going to be my next talk. I'll give you the answer to that question. Rob's going to have to invite me back 2 years from now. That's really an interesting koan to me. How do we hold that? Is that interesting to other people? How to work with that? Mm-hmm. So, according to the attachment people, we suffer when we don't live in harmony with how we're biologically wired. So I think we need both. We need to develop a stream of well-being within ourselves, like the Buddhists and the spiritual people would say, and we need to open ourselves and avail ourselves to the healthy, wonderful connections that are available with other human beings. I think there's a way we need to hold complexity and work with both of those things. The Dalai Lama said, if we find that science says something that contradicts Buddhism, then Buddhism needs to change, not science. So I don't know if attachment theory contradicts Buddhism. I think there's a way through this if we can see the second noble truth not as desire, but as craving. It's something about craving that leads to suffering. But even then, I think we need to work with our craving, because it's so easy to denigrate craving and judge that as aspect of ourselves. Because to be human is just sometimes, well, desire can easily morph into craving and clinging, yeah? But the important thing is, how do we work with that? How do we work with that clinging and that craving? And things like focusing, which I'll talk about in a little bit, which Bruce teaches and Laurie here teaches, help give us some ways to enter ourselves to work with those cravings and those desires. Okay, in a little while, I'm going to give you a little heads up here. We're going to do a little bit of a role play, so I'll be able to demonstrate some of these points a little bit more clearly. So you might want to think about whether you want to be brave enough to volunteer. I need two people in a little bit here. I think it'll be fun. Fun for me. Okay. So in spiritual circles, there's often a lot of talk about compassion and forgiveness and loving and letting go of things that don't work for us. You've heard this? And I have to admit, it drives me a little crazy when I hear people talking about these things. Because for me, it raises the question, well, it all sounds really great, but how do we do it? How do we let go? What's involved? What's the process through which we let go and move on? To me, that's a much more interesting and important question, or even koan. How do we do that? We can't forgive just through an act of will. Forgiveness to me is like the last stage in a process of healing. If you've been hurt, you can't just forgive. You can only do that in your mind and kind of maybe delude yourself with the thinking that you've let go of it in your body. But your body doesn't lie. It's still grieving. It's still holding on to something. And you need to go through that emotional process, that grieving process. And then letting go, at some point, it just happens naturally. Forgiveness becomes the next natural step. But you have to go through the process. You can't do this process skipping thing that a lot of people want to do, where they skip over their feelings. You have to work with them in a wise way. So that's really the key of what my talk's about. But the key is really to work with our feelings and work with our longings and work with our desires, not try to get rid of them, not judge them, not think that they're hindrances, not think that they're defilements, which is a word often used a lot in Buddhism. It's just part of being human, and we need to embrace it and work with it. So I'm interested in how... And the other thing people talk about is to be unconditionally loving. You've heard this expression a lot. And it's a great idea. I love it.
It's a great idea.
Isn't it? And it's an important thing to do with your children, to be unconditionally loving and accepting. But in adult relationships, we need something back. There needs to be mutuality. Maybe you're not going to like this idea. But check it out with your own experience. I think as adults, we need mutuality. The obvious example is like being with somebody who's abusive. Do you be unconditionally loving and just tolerate the abuse? That's probably not being very unconditionally loving toward yourself, right? Maybe you can love that person better from a distance. Maybe you can be unconditionally loving after you break up and you have a little space. you know, but in a intimate relationship, there needs to be mutuality, don't you think?
I think that's true. Totally.
Yeah. So that's another one of those concepts that kind of drives me a little crazy. So the practice is to stay connected to ourself. This is really the key in terms of like a yoga of intimacy, staying connected to yourself as you're in relationship with another person. That's really the art and the challenge. Like, how do we stay connected in our own being when we're with somebody else? And I'm going to talk a little bit about focusing later as one way to do that. And there's a quote by Walter Kempler that I really like. Bruce actually turned me on to this quote. It's a great quote. He says, autonomy and intimacy are two sides of a spinning coin. Mm-hmm. Autonomy and intimacy are two sides of a spinning coin. Like, we need both. We need the connection with our own being and to open to another being. Okay. So intimacy with others begins by being intimate with yourself. It's another way to talk about it. And my book, Being Intimate, talks about that and how we need to cultivate that intimacy with ourselves and focusing. Some of you know focusing, by the way? Some of you are familiar with it? Yeah. Yeah, so maybe a third. Okay. But there are ways to go inside ourselves where we really connect with what's alive for us in the moment. We kind of even notice how things feel in our body, not just what we think in our mind. And that's a real way to connect with our own being. And beneath a lot of our complaints and criticisms, not that any of you here ever have those, of other people, is often an unacknowledged feeling and an unacknowledged need or desire. And, you know, for example, if your partner criticizes you and kind of makes you angry, your impulse is probably to attack. But if you look deeper beneath the anger, what's there? It's probably sadness, hurt, maybe fear that the relationship might not last. It's something more vulnerable. So part of the yoga of intimacy is cultivating the courage to really look honestly at yourself, really being willing to be radically honest with yourself and notice what you're really feeling and what you're really wanting and acknowledge that to yourself. That might sound easy to do, but that's not easy to do because it's often very vulnerable, right? To acknowledge what's really happening. Maybe especially more for men, think it's kind of a weakness to be vulnerable and to show sadness or fear or shame or the more those kind of feelings. But it actually takes a tremendous amount of strength and power. And it actually gives you a lot of power to honor what's really true for you and to express that. So beneath the impulse to attack, maybe there's sadness, maybe there's hurt. And beneath that is something that you need, or along with that is something that you need. Maybe you need to be spoken to more respectfully, or you need reassurance of some kind. So to be able to express those needs and those desires is also an important part of the yoga of intimacy. And practices such as focusing and mindfulness meditation can be really helpful in that regard, because they help us develop a stronger connection with our own being, with our own self. You know, to tell you, I've been doing therapy for over 30 years. Clients often come in, especially couples, and they tell me, we're having a communication problem. Are there some of you therapists out there? Does this sound familiar? People come in, and they're right, they're having a communication problem. But more fundamentally, they're having a self-awareness problem, a mindfulness problem. Like, they're not really aware of what they're experiencing. Communication is only effective to the extent that we know what we're experiencing inside, right? I mean, I could say to you, you know, I really think you're a total jerk. And that's communicating. My communication is really clear, right? Being very direct. But it's not really communicating what you're really experiencing. It's communicating your judgments, your perceptions about it. That's what people usually do. They communicate their perceptions and they think they're communicating their feelings, but they're not. I feel like you're a very selfish person. That's not a feeling, that's a perception. Right? So later we're going to try to go into this. What does it look like to actually share your actual feelings? Because it's easy to have perceptions, and it's safe to have perceptions of other people and judge them, but it usually just pushes people away. Have you found that?
Yeah.
When you judge, you analyze somebody, you diagnose them, you tell them what you think's wrong with them, does that ever work? Usually not, right? People aren't going to say, you know, you're right, I'm a jerk, I didn't realize it. I'm so glad you told me. Why didn't anybody ever tell me that before? I'm going to reform myself now. Okay. It makes people defensive, doesn't it? And it just leads to an escalation of conflict. Okay, I think we should do this role play now. And what I want to demonstrate is, how can we communicate our feelings and needs in a way that doesn't activate other people's amygdala? Have some of you tuned into neuroscience at all? It's very popular right now, neuroscience and the psychology of the brain. Now, we have an ancient part of our brain called the amygdala. It scans the environment for danger, for threats. And it kept us alive for many millions of years, because if you see a tiger in the wild, you know, you want to run, right? Or maybe if it's not a tiger, but a less threatening animal, maybe you attack. So we have this built-in fight-flight mechanism. Or now it's called the fight-flight-freeze mechanism to protect us from real or imagined danger. So we have this thing in us that's kept us alive for a long time. It's really served us to keep us alive in threatening situations. But it doesn't come out. There aren't too many tigers out there now. But there are people out there. There are people who might judge us. You know, people who might criticize us. People who might shame us. People who might leave us. And then we're going to be alone. And all those are tremendous threats to our being, to our organism. And that triggers the fight-flight mechanism when we feel a threat interpersonally. That makes sense? So knowing this, it leads to the question, well, how can we communicate in ways that are less likely to threaten other people and to make them defensive, to escalate conflict? And how can we communicate in ways that are more likely to invite people toward us instead of pushing them away or threatening them? Does that make sense? And I'll demonstrate this, because it'll make more sense, I think. Okay, so this first role play, I'm going to do two. This first one is really short, and I need a couple. Not a real couple. That wouldn't be good. I mean, it could work. It might be fun. So I should leave the option open to that. But you like to volunteer?
Sure.
Okay, that's brave.
Do I need to come to the front?
Yeah, come, you know, standing here. Would anyone like to be this lovely man's partner for 3 minutes?
I won't bite.
You might want to read this first to see what kind of,
some kind,
see
of,
the kind of trouble you're going to get into.
Somewhere.
Yeah, there's a script. There's a script, so it's easy. Please, yeah. So, thanks very much. So read your lines there. You can improvise a tiny bit, but try to stay with the scripts. But read it first before you start, so you get a little sense of what kind of trouble you're going to get into here. Any questions so far or comments? Questions or comments? Any questions? No? Okay. Is this, am I being clear? Please, yeah.
Sure.
Well, then, more time for conversation later.
Yeah, we can talk more later, yeah.
Be good to call you.
Be good as a friend?
Yeah, you're right.
Are you guys ready?
Definitely.
Okay.
We need to talk.
You just do it loud enough so they can hear you.
We need to talk.
You always need to talk. What did I do wrong this time?
There you go, shutting down again. I don't know what your problem is. Can't you just hear me out?
Okay, what?
The relationship isn't working out the way I expected.
What do you mean?
I'm not getting enough affection from you. If you really loved me, you'd be more affectionate. We hardly cuddle anymore, and you don't seem to want to hug me very much.
I guess I'm never going to make you happy. I do hug you. Whatever I do is never enough for you. You know I love you, so I don't see what the problem is.
How can I know if you never show it? You don't show me love the way you used to.
Oh, you're crazy.
Yeah. Crazy to think you're ever going to change.
Okay. You can sit down and then I'll cover you from there. So what did you notice there?
Good acting.
Good acting.
The script.
The script. That seemed realistic? Did that seem kind of realistic, and people talk that way with each other? Yeah. So what did you notice? How did it feel in your own body to watch that?
Terrible.
Felt terrible. Yeah. Other people too, it felt, it's kind of yuck. Imagine how it felt in their body to have that conversation. Right? Anything you want to say about that? How that felt to you? You don't have to, but...
Sounded like I was the typical insensitive male.
The typical insensitive male, which of course you're not. So just to make that totally clear.
I don't like being the typical insensitive. I have my time for it.
Sure. Yeah, we all do. Sure. Yeah. Anything you want to say about how that was? You don't have to. That's fine.
I don't know. I think
I've
felt that way before.
You felt that way before? Yeah. This feels kind of a little familiar.
Like an insensitive male?
Needy
female. So what did you observe? Anyone else want to say what you noticed there?
Was there denial?
Denial.
There's no feelings there. It's just like a lot of judgment.
A lot of judgments. Right.
Diagnosing.
They're not sharing their feelings, yeah. Right? They're not really slowing down and going inside and noticing what they're experiencing, right?
A lot of sweeping generalizations and never and always. And
yeah, words like never and always are really difficult. And
yeah. What was the very beginning? Because it seemed like it got off track, right? Right to the response.
Yeah, she wanted to talk. And he got defensive right away. He said, what did I do wrong this time?
That's right.
So that's called defensiveness, mm-hmm. Right? Or stonewalling, like not wanting to talk. And men tend to do this more than women statistically. Well, the women can do it too. And then she attacked him, right? She said, there you go, shutting down again. I don't know what your problem is. So what's the likely response when he's attacked? He's going to get defensive and attack back, right? So so this is called escalation happens, adding fuel to the fire. And they just get more and more out of their bodies, more and more disconnected from what they're really feeling. And more suffering happens because they're not communicating what's really happening for them, right? So then he gets defensive again, says, I guess I'm never going to make you happy. And then he says, I do hug you, which may or may not be true. Right? Sorry. So it just deteriorates really quickly. So... He's clinging to his defenses. You can see how clinging and craving operate here if you want to use Buddhist language. He's clinging to his defenses, right? She's clinging to her attacks, and it's creating a lot of suffering. You can see how clinging and craving shows up in our relationships in a destructive way. They're not present with each other. There's no listening happening, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know the Jewish saying? There's a Jewish saying, God gave us two ears but one mouth. And the one interpretation of that is it's twice as hard to listen than it is to speak. Or the other interpretation is we need to work twice as hard at listening than speaking. Right? Yeah. It's a hard one. So she's also clinging to her assumptions that he doesn't love her. And that drives him crazy because he feels like he does love her. So that accusation drives him crazy. It activates his amygdala because then he feels a threat. So that's, again, he attacks her back. So this demonstrates four things that John Gottman talks about. Is somebody familiar with the research of John Gottman with couples? He's probably done the best research on couples. He sets up couples in a hotel with video cameras on for a long weekend. And then tells them to act naturally. And what he noticed is there are four things that lead to marital decline and eventual divorce. So, is somebody familiar with John Gottman? Do you remember what those four things are? Criticism, contempt, stonewalling, and defensiveness. Criticism, contempt, stonewalling, and defensiveness. Four things that tend to add to the soup of what happens when people eventually divorce or are very unhappy in the relationship. And you can see all four operating here. So I want to... any questions before we move on from that? So we're going to move into a second dialogue in about 5 minutes or so and give them a chance to redeem themselves.
Yeah.
But any other questions or comments about this? Okay. So the next dialogue is going to start in the same way, but you'll notice that they do something different this time. Actually, I should give you the dialogue so you can take a look at it before. And this dialogue happens after they've learned a little bit of focusing. And I know you guys haven't learned focusing, but that's okay because you guys are naturals anyway, being able to be with yourselves. This one's longer. But this demonstrates how the dialogue can really change quite dramatically when people slow down, you know, when they pause. Because we don't do that. When the amygdala gets activated, we don't pause, right? We just go right into the fight-flight mode. So it's part of the yoga of intimacy to take a breath, you know, to relax. I mean, this is a great place to bring your spiritual practice in, into relationships. Isn't it the hardest place, though, to bring your spiritual practice in? Because when you're activated, everything goes out the window, right? I mean, I'm sure you've known people who consider themselves very spiritual, and then when they get activated, they kind of lose it. None of you do that here, I'm sure. maybe you know people who are like that. So why does that happen so quickly? And despite the best ideas we have and the best intentions we have, we just get crazy sometimes, right? We get activated because those deeper vulnerabilities are getting activated. So that's the non-crazy part. I mean, that makes it understandable why we react so intensely. Because something really deeply vulnerable is getting activated. Our longing to connect, our longing for intimacy, for belonging is coming to the surface. And so it's natural, it's understandable that when that's threatened, we go into the fight-flight mode. So the antidote to that is to develop some practice, some kind of mindfulness practice, where we kind of go inside, we take a breath, we pause, and kind of go inside, and we be present to what we're noticing in our actual experience, our felt experience. And that might be physical sensations. It might be a jumpiness in our stomach, a tightness in our chest. It might be physical things to notice. And just being mindful of it, it's quite amazing. Even if it's something unpleasant, when you bring mindfulness to what you're really feeling inside, it tends to settle out. It tends to have a calming effect. Or you might notice feelings and emotions. You might notice hurt or sadness or fear. But it takes time to get in touch with those more vulnerable feelings. Usually the anger is the thing we're most aware of. But if you take time, you pause, you slow down. And this next dialogue, I'm encouraging both of them to go really slowly into this dialogue, to take your time when you have this dialogue and kind of go inside yourself and notice how things are feeling inside as you're having this conversation. It can really change the whole dynamic. Let's see if there's anything more I want to say about that. Okay, so in this dialogue, you're going to see them embodying what some of the principles of focusing. And now some of you are familiar with focusing, but let me talk about that for about 3 minutes, because it might prepare you a little bit. Some of you know focusing a little bit? It was developed by a man named Eugene Gemlin at the University of Chicago. It's one of the best research personal growth methods around, really. He did a lot of research in the 60s on this. And he found that when people were progressing in psychotherapy, they were doing something quite naturally within themselves that other clients weren't doing. Namely, they were slowing down their speech, they were getting connected to their felt experience. They were going slowly, they were maybe stammering a little bit. They weren't so articulate. They were taking their time, going inside and saying, well, when he said that to me, I felt kind of angry about it. And, well, not really angry. It was more, it kind of hurt when he spoke to me that way. And there was a lot of pausing in these clients, a lot of going very slowly and attending to how their body was feeling. So Gemlin developed this into teachable steps that other people could learn. And then he wrote the book Focusing, which I don't know if that's available here in the bookstore, but a lot of people are since then have been writing about focusing, including me, including Lori. I have a good, nice, good book on using focusing in art therapy. And it's very popular. It's getting a little more popular now. So the key part of focusing is to cultivate what's called the focusing attitude. And that's an attitude of gentleness and kindness and acceptance of whatever you're experiencing. And it's very similar, actually, to Tara Brach wrote. Some of you familiar with her book, Radical Acceptance? It's a really great book, and she actually knows focusing, and it's like a mindfulness approach, because it's really being mindful of your feelings, mindful of your felt experience, and it's very subtle. It's a little hard to explain, but you might get a little flavor of it through the role play. But it's really slowing down, and it's something that people do quite naturally. Jenlin says he didn't invent focusing, he just observed it in people who were doing this quite naturally. So it's something probably all of you do to some extent, if not a lot already. But it helps kind of fine-tune it, to know that there's kind of a process to going into your body, noticing how you're feeling in your body, because that's where all the intense emotions are, is in your body, right? I mean, the fight-flight response is a bodily event. It's happening in your body. The body's activated, it's geared up, the heart's racing, it's geared up to running away, right, from the tiger. Or shutting down, freezing. So emotions that come up in relationships are also a bodily event. And to access what's happening in a bodily way, that's an intense kind of yoga practice, mindfulness practice, to go into your body and slow down and attend to what you're really feeling, and then find words that express it to the other person. So then they have some more of a clue what's happening in your heart, what's happening in your inner world. And that's the climate that we want to create for intimacy. Intimacy, connection that we're longing for can't be created unless we learn how to create this climate for intimacy. Well, we can't control people, we can't control intimacy, but what we can do is create a climate where it's more likely to happen. It kind of arises through grace, just kind of arises kind of as a gift. If we're in the right place and the other person's in a similar place, it just kind of arises. But all we can do is put ourselves in a place where it's more likely to happen. That makes sense? Because we can go crazy trying to control it, trying to control the other person. Okay, so you've read your lines. Have you gotten through it?
Well,
it's a long one.
I'm doing a little bit of, what do you call that? Suspense or whatever.
A little bit of suspense with this one?
Yeah. I'm not sure what
Don't worry,
thing.
Me too. I'm going to freestyle.
It'll be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We can ask for other volunteers, since you've already fulfilled your responsibilities earlier. But is it okay?
Yeah, I don't mind, but if somebody else wants to do it, does anybody else want to try?
Okay.
Not so many volunteers.
we could probably constrict a few people. We could do a lottery or something. But if you're so willing to do it, I appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay, I'll see.
Okay, so it's better if you come up here. And
yes.
And again, this is like I've actually.
Okay. I don't know.
So. Okay. These people have actually been in therapy with me for 25 years doing focusing. And it takes about that long to learn this process.
I started when I was 1 year old.
You were one when you started.
Okay.
Young
now. But I just want to preface that because it really takes a lot of time to practice going inside and in this kind of way that they're going to demonstrate. Okay.
I need to talk to you. Is this a good time?
Well, I guess this time is okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it's okay. Thank you for asking.
This relationship isn't going where I wanted it to go.
Oh, God. Here we go again. I do everything for you, and it's never enough. I guess I'm being a little defensive.
More than little defensive.
Don't rope it in, okay?
You're right. I don't mean to attack you. I'm sorry.
Okay, so the relationship isn't going the way you want. Do you want to say some more of what you mean?
Yes, but are you sure you want to hear this?
Well, this is a touchy issue for me. It's hard to hear that I'm not making you happy, but go ahead.
I'm feeling disappointed and sad about a relationship.
That's hard to hear. I try so hard to please you. My stomach is feeling really tight. Okay, it's easing a little. Tell me more of what you're sad about.
Something changed. You seem distant. You don't show me love the way you used to.
Are you serious? I work so hard to support the family. I help with housework. I do a lot to show that I love you.
Okay, I'm getting defensive again. I'm sorry. I can really feel my blood boiling. Just give me a minute. My breathing is really tired. Okay, I hear what you're not feeling love. How would you like me to show you love?
Well, one way would be to hug me more. I don't get any affection from you.
It drives me crazy when you say that. I do hug you.
Really? Like when?
Just the other day when you were doing the dishes. I came from behind you and put my arms around you. You don't remember that?
You know, you're right. I guess I forgot about that.
It feels good to hear you say that. You know, I'm not trying to be critical, but whenever I hug you lately, you don't seem very receptive.
I think I've got a wall up now. I've been unhappy for so long.
I'm sorry to hear that. When I sense you're closed down, I don't feel like hugging you. I don't feel welcome. I don't feel safe. I shut down. For the first few years of our relationship, you melted when I hugged you. I love that. I don't mean to be critical, but you seem very distant lately, and I feel blamed a lot. It's not so easy to move towards you.
Well, that makes sense to me. I can understand why you don't approach me the way you used to. I'm not very open. It's easier for me to see how you're distant, but I guess I'm also protecting myself by keeping you away.
Okay, it feels good to hear you acknowledge that. We seem to be caught in this cycle where we're each protecting ourselves, and the distance just keeps growing.
Yeah, I know I can be blaming and critical. I can see more clearly how that pushes you away. But underneath that, I guess I'm just sad and lonely, and I get afraid of where things are headed.
I can understand that. You know, it's a lot easier to hear the sadness and fear. The anger and criticism push me away. I have more empathy for you when you're vulnerable and you tell me your feelings.
I really don't want to blame you. It doesn't feel good in my body when I do that. Maybe we can try something different. I'll try to be more open to your hugs. I'll try to be more receptive. Maybe it will be easier now that we've talked.
That would be great. If I felt you were letting me in more, I'd probably give you more hugs and be more affectionate. Can I make a request?
Sure.
It would help me if you asked for a hug when you wanted one.
Okay, I'll try to do that. That's a fair request. But it would also be great if you hugged me even when I don't ask.
Sure, I think this will be a lot easier to do now.
Thanks for listening to me. I feel better that we talked about this.
Me too.
Can I have a hug now? Okay.
Okay, thank you so much. You did a good job. Thank you so much. That was great, wasn't it? You did really well. Thank you. Appreciate that. So what did you notice there?
They caught themselves.
They caught themselves. How did you feel listening to that dialogue, by the way?
Yeah. They didn't attack.
They didn't attack, right?
There's a lot more tentativeness.
More tentativeness, right. They weren't like clinging so tightly to their beliefs about the other person. Mm-hmm. Huh?
And I felt much more relaxed, and there was a sense of humor in it almost, touching them.
You felt relaxed.
Touch.
You felt more relaxed. Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, to say that.
It was an actual conversation.
Mm-hmm. It was an actual conversation.
Uh-huh. The other one wasn't a conversation.
Right. Yeah. Right, good point. Yeah, they were really communicating what they were experiencing. They were taking some risks there to show their hearts to each other.
There were attempts to repair instead of just blaming each other?
Yeah, there were attempts to repair. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you said that. That's another word John Gottman uses in his research, that when one person makes a repair attempt and the other person doesn't pick up on it, it tends to make things a lot worse. Mm-hmm. Right? So here there were attempts to repair things, and the other person picked up on it, and it worked.
I really enjoyed how he really paused and took a breath.
He paused, yes.
Yeah. And then that totally changes, even his facial expression when he was reading.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if nothing else, if you leave today with just one little tip, is when you're in the midst of this kind of unpleasant non-conversation, when this unpleasant dialogue with somebody, take a moment and tell the person, wait a minute, I need a moment right now. I need a minute to because something's going on in me. Because basically what you're saying, something's going on and I don't want to attack you. I don't want to make things worse. I need a minute to soothe myself. Now, we need to bring some self-soothing skills in. And being mindful of what you're experiencing is actually a self-soothing skill. I think the best one, really. To notice what's happening in your body, what you're feeling inside. Take a moment. Yeah, at one point, just to follow up on what you were saying, you notice that he was getting defensive again, right? He said, oh God, here we go again. I do everything for you and it's never enough. So he started off being defensive, right? But the thing is that he caught himself. Like he became mindful of what he was doing. So you don't have to be perfect in having a relationship. It's not demanding perfection because we're going to slip. But the good news is we can repair it. You know, there's a process called slipping and repairing. We're constantly going to slip and lose it at times. But the good news is we can recover, we can catch ourselves. You know, we can apologize or come back later maybe, come back the next day even if it doesn't get resolved, and have a reparative, what's called a reparative conversation, and try to repair whatever damage was done. So there's a lot of ways to work with this. And then fortunately when he said, he acknowledged he was getting defensive, remember what she said? She said more than a little defensive. Mm-hmm. Right, so she was attacking him, right? And that could have gone bad very quickly at that point. Can you see that? Because here he is trying to acknowledge that it's something vulnerable. Yes, I got defensive. And then she's kind of really rubbing it in, right? But he was aware enough to be able to say that, you know, don't rub it in. He was able to stand up for himself and say something instead of just collapsing like a lot of people do. I think a lot of men especially tend to collapse quickly if a woman is not happy with them. Happens the other way too, but you get see what I'm understand what I'm saying.
But then she backed off.
Yeah, she backed off when he's kind of stood up for himself. Right, she backed off. Said, "I'm sorry, you're right. I don't mean to attack you." So we have to give her a lot of credit there, right? She then became aware and she acknowledged it. That takes a lot of strength, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. To acknowledge when we're a little bit off. Yeah, you're right. I was attacking you. That took a lot of mindfulness for her to do that. And that's why I say this is after like 20 years of therapy, right? Of learning focusing, because it takes time to be able to catch oneself in that.
He also expressed, at one point, he expressed a strong emotion about, what you said makes my blood boil. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, they were able to hold that.
Right, so again, he was talking from his bodily felt experience. That's like classical focusing process. Like he was going inside and he found an image to express how his body was feeling. He feels like blood's boiling right now. And just being able to express congruently, in other words, express accurately what you're feeling, it can have like a healing effect. It can have a connecting kind of an effect to express what we're really feeling inside. And she was able to hear that without getting defensive, so that was good.
But expressing in a way that it was his experience, not you make me feel.
Right, right.
Which
it was,
is what
yeah.
people say all the time.
Yeah, people,
you make me feel, and I go like, I wish I had that power over you, but I don't.
You're not that powerful. Well, that's a good point. People, you know, the difference between I statements and you statements,
yeah.
There's been a lot written about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to know that we shouldn't use you statements than to actually use I statements,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what an I statement is. It's going inside, and it's connecting with what you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not so easy to do. I mean, it's simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah, it takes a lot of 20 years.
But a lot of you, you know, one of the advantages of getting older is we have a lot more experience and a lot more practice with going inside. So, you know, this is something where you can really use your meditation practice to use whatever mindfulness practice you've developed to kind of use it in the arena of relationship. Right. What else did you notice in that last dialogue? Anyone else?
Apparently both of the parties care about one another. In other words, to me the challenge can be in a relationship where one of the parties loses interest to maintain and continue the relationship.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So the conversation then, or the meeting, as much as one wants to express their love and care, deep in their heart, they block that.
Connection.
So mm-hmm. You know, I did sense with this couple that they did care enough about each other to want to engage.
Yeah.
But
each of them were picking up signals.
Each of them were picking up signals?
Each of them were picking up signals from the other that they that there was a lack of caring.
That there was caring.
He was getting that from her, too.
Yeah, in the first dialogue, he was probably feeling that there wasn't much caring. But Richard's saying in the second dialogue, he could feel that there was caring between them, and that kind of helped motivate them and keep them going. It kind of provided the juice to keep being willing to dialogue with each other.
You find in your work that much of the time, one of the parties wants to completely drop out, that they've lost
the... Sure.
Yeah.
That can happen, yeah. I mean, usually if they come into couples therapy, they usually both want to work on it, but that varies too. Sometimes people come in because they just want to find a way to gracefully exit from the relationship. But a lot of people won't really want to work it out if they can. They just don't know how the tools or the skills. They don't know how to do it. So the people have to be willing to try something different.
It felt like the second time around that I was explaining what emotions I was going through, and taking the time out to really express my feelings instead of playing the blame game and getting caught in blaming my spouse for, you know, what was going on.
Right. How did it feel to do that? How was that?
I was definitely feeling more open-hearted the second time and more sensitive to trying to convey the message clearly of how I was feeling inside of me so she could understand what I was going through, the emotions that I was going through.
Uh-huh.
And the first one was kind of more just, you should already know what I'm
going through.
Isn't it obvious?
You should already know. See, that's also, I talk about this in my book, The Authentic Heart, which I would recommend to you if I can put in a sales pitch for it. But the difference between what I call young love and mature love, like in young love, we make a lot of assumptions. We think people should be able to read our mind. And a more mature version of love is we realize it's our responsibility to communicate what we want and what we need. So it felt better, and it feels good to do that, doesn't it? It felt better to talk from your actual experience.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And the tempo of the conversation was slow enough to give space for them to turn inward.
Yeah, that's a key thing, because often the pace is so quick, isn't it, when couples talk with each other, and it's just rapid fire, it's a rapid fire ping pong match. So it needs to be more of like a slow motion ping pong match. Just going very slowly and pausing and taking time and going inside. And, you know, we don't get any training in that right in our society.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get any education, any guidance, any encouragement to slow down and communicate in this different kind of way. So it's kind of revolutionary to think about having relationships more in this kind of way, where we go very slowly, we take our time, we don't expect ourselves to come up with some immediate feeling or to communicate anything brilliant immediately, but instead we say, you know, I need a minute, wait, something's going on, I'm not sure what it is, let me take a moment and go inside and get connected to what's happening for me. And then gradually something will come.
And it also didn't feel life or death. The first scenario felt life and death, black and white.
Yeah.
Dangerous.
Yeah, the first one was kind of a lot of fear, probably, and a lot of hurt underneath, and a lot of despair. Just kind of giving up on any possibility and just kind of feeling some gratification and just attacking each other. You know, it gives you like a quick hit of some release to attack the other person, but it doesn't give you any lasting fulfillment, right? So it takes work. This is kind of like why I see it as like a yoga of intimacy or a spiritual practice. You know, the work is to slow down, go inside of ourselves, access what we're really experiencing, and then finding the words that convey what we're experiencing. Right? It takes a lot of courage to do that and a lot of mindfulness to do all that. Yeah, please.
I think a part of the problem, I think, has to do with leading with words instead of with feelings, because feelings make the space and then the language can surface in the space after. By the feelings, but we're so accustomed in this culture to leading with words, and by the time a feeling has become a word, it's almost too late.
So words are overrated.
I think they're misused. I don't think we've really discovered them yet. I think hopefully we're in the process of I don't think we're have actually developed that that intimate relationship with the words.
Yeah. So maybe another way to
And we can't be more intimate with our with each other than we are with our our language.
So I think what I'm hearing you say, if I can use slightly different words, although words are always hazardous to use, or words are really only approximations to what we're feeling inside, and often they're really bad approximations. They don't really, the word can't quite capture the felt experience.
They don't have to be.
But your suggestion is to slow down and just tune more into the feeling, and maybe there can be like a nonverbal connection that can happen. And nonverbal kind of appreciation of each other.
Gestural. I like watching people signing.
Or gestures. But that's part of focusing too. People, it doesn't have to be words. It can be an image that comes to you, maybe that says something, or a gesture. It's something that speaks from the felt sense. Laurie does great work with this with expressive arts, like connecting with your felt sense and then finding some way to express it that isn't words. Because I think you're right, words can lend themselves to a lot of misunderstanding. So thanks for that comment, yeah. But, you know, but words are one of the things we have. So I think we should avail ourselves of words, just try to be as skillful and careful as possible when we do use them. And try to track the feeling that the words are pointing toward. It's like the finger pointing toward the moon. Try to get a sense of what the person's experiencing when they're using words.
Ideally, the words can be experiential. They don't have to be a bell. Ideally, the word can be the thing itself. If we're clear in the moment, I think. And I think that we're naturally intimate too, and that we're educated out of the natural intimacy of the moment, and we have to rediscover it. We learn what we knew as children were infants. So a lot has to do with, I think, healing a wound of language.
Uh-huh. I think it depends in part how we grew up. If we had good parenting, then we have more access, because we have more of a secure internal base. Mm-hmm. And if our childhood was one that was fraught with disconnection and trauma and abuse, it's probably don't want to duplicate that, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah. What are you?
I think it's also like the slowing down so we can hear what's inside of us to share, but then there's the presence of the other person and the two ears, more than two ears, the listening.
Yeah.
So just that it's the whole thing is so necessary. So listening inside is one step. And then, you know, really, I mean, the demonstration, it's like you really listened. The listening was so important to be able to hear each other.
Yeah,
and to receive it, to digest it. Actually, instead of the ping pong, I got the word, like, to have a catch. You can, like, hold the ball for a while and then toss it back.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Hold it.
You hold the ball with the frisbee a little longer. Just kind of hold it. It's kind of like listening to yourself, attending to yourself. You know, sometimes people sometimes think that's kind of selfish. It feels a little awkward to attend to yourself, but it's really powerful practice. Mm-hmm. Spend some time, go inside, attend to yourself. If you have two people willing to do that, it can be really powerful. It can be really beautiful. Exactly. So yeah, I like that. To listen to yourself and then to feel received, to receive the other person. Often we don't pay much attention to receiving. And that's often harder than giving, is receiving. Mm-hmm. So allowing yourself to receive the connection. Because we're kind of out of control when we're receiving. It's easier to give in a certain kind of way because we're more in control. But to receive, just let ourselves feel good. Just to receive the connection or feel the connection with somebody. It takes a lot of vulnerability to really let that in. That's a great yoga practice too. That's a great spiritual practice to receive. Sometimes, again, we think that's being selfish. But it's actually being egotistical to not receive. Because you're actually doing something to put up an obstacle to receiving. And then that's when the ego comes in, because you're blocking, putting up a block to receiving. So that's very egotistical, actually. If that makes any sense. Okay, any other comments or questions? So we're getting a little toward the end of our time here. You can see how the fight-flight response was being less triggered in them, because they were communicating more from their feelings, so they weren't threatening each other. So we can maybe review then, unless there's any final comments or questions. So I just want to review a little bit then. We tend to push intimacy away when we can't tolerate, this is another way to say it, we can't tolerate the sensations that are coming up in us as a result of being with somebody. Often there's uncomfortable sensations that are coming up. You know, from a Buddhist point of view, there's pleasant sensation, unpleasant sensations, and neutral sensations. So if we can apply mindfulness of body and mindfulness of feelings and go inside, we can notice the pleasant quality, the unpleasant quality of a sensation. And just kind of notice that, name it, and then share that like they did in the dialogue. You know, that makes my stomach really tight when you say that. He was sharing an unpleasant sensation. He was noticing it. He was mindful enough to notice that and then communicate it. So then we need to cultivate inner resources to hold the discomfort or to hold the anxiety in ourselves instead of acting it out immediately. Because that's what we do. We're so uncomfortable that we explode or implode. We can't hold those uncomfortable feelings. That's when we tend to get angry and explode, right? Because something's coming up that we can't tolerate. So again, it's kind of a spiritual practice to expand our tolerance for uncomfortable sensations in our body. And that creates more equanimity. And then the third thing is we often don't know how to soothe ourselves. So this can also be seen as a self-soothing practice, to go inside and find ways to calm and soothe ourselves. So there's a lot more, this is back to the essence of the books that I'm writing about, is we need to cultivate intimacy with ourselves as a foundation for intimacy with other people. I think that's a core part of the practice. Okay. Well, I think that's about all I wanted to say. I don't want to keep you too long, so you've been really patient, but any final thoughts? Does this make any sense? Does it feel like it's something you could practice when you go home? You can try some of this in your. I mean, you can use